All right, now for the finale, we'll have some detective work. Russell Miller is a collector of classical instrumental and orchestral 78s, and, if you will, an accumulator of recordings in many formats and musical styles. He does not claim to play any musical instrument other than the phonograph, and he makes his living in the software business. He's involved with his local collectors group, the New England Society for the Preservation of Recorded Sound, and he attends most of those meetings, but he'll have to miss the one they're having tomorrow in New Hampshire because of today's session. Small sacrifice, Russell. I think so. Russell Miller.
PDF file on this drive.
Sure. I can get that going for you.
Good morning, and thank you all very much. I'll get this underway in a moment.
Is it the one on top here?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And let me just mirror these screens real quick.
You're up? Oh, perfect. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know what all this other stuff is, but that should work.
Oh, okay.
Is there a full screen?
Oh, yeah, there's... read mode, it's going to be, thank you very much.
I remember.
Yes, very good. I found out the other day that my optometrist, whom I see every year, has not had his eyes examined for, you know, the last 5 or 6 years. He thinks everything is going okay, but... I guess he's not exactly sure. So even though I make my living in computers, I am certainly not immune from computer crises and all sorts of last-minute shenanigans. So in my presentation, we'll find you won't be looking much at what's up on the screen. There are a couple things that I will show that... I think are of particular interest, and otherwise I may be holding up an item from time to time, like a CD. But I think we'll get across what we need to get across here. I have always taken a great interest in recordings by composers. I suppose ever since I first learned that Rachmaninoff had recorded his own piano concertos. I thought, well, sort of the thinking in the naive way, well, now we know how it's supposed to go. This is, you know, what the composer says, you know, and that's it. And then I learned that there are plenty of arguments on the other side. Maybe a composer doesn't necessarily have the skills that other musicians have, you know, as an instrumentalist, as a conductor, even as an interpreter of music. Maybe the composer's way is just one way of doing things, and when the composer puts on his or her performer's hat, you know, then it's time to think about how to put the music across, and the composer's way is simply another way of doing it among many. But I think it's true that we would love to know how Bach and Mozart and Chopin would play their own music. And so it's very valuable, I think, that we can hear for ourselves how Stravinsky or Strauss did the same thing in their recordings. But for some recordings, there are more basic questions that need to be addressed. In the field of historical recordings, attributions are sometimes wrong, and they're sometimes wrong by mistake, and they can be wrong because of deliberate deception. The particular cases that I would like to explore today are two major composers, Jean Sibelius and Sergei Prokofiev, who made very few recordings, and in both cases, there are questions that have arisen that I think, without having all the answers, we can shed a little light on. We'll start with Sibelius. On the 1st of January, 1939, Jean Sibelius participated in a radio program in Helsinki, broadcast via shortwave to the United States, as one of a series of tributes from various countries, tributes to the World's Fair that opened later that year in New York. Sibelius had not conducted an orchestra for many years at that time. He conducted earlier in his career, but he was convinced to come to the radio studio, and the work that was chosen for the occasion was a short piece that he had written sometime earlier on Dante Festivo. Now, in the 1970s, EMI, on its World Record Club label, issued some of their historical recordings of performances of Sibelius music, and a recording was issued that claimed to be Sibelius conducting the Andante Festivo, and it was, in fact, a recording that had been supplied by the Finnish Radio Archives. And we'll hear just a little bit of it. This is track one. In 1995, Finnish Music Quarterly published an article entitled The True and False on Dante Festivo. Not long before that, a Finnish music magazine called Classica had produced a cover mount CD. They had obtained from the broadcast archives a tape of the Andante Festivo. In this case, the engineer had gone back to their original discs of the entire broadcast and sorted through that and a number of disc copies that had been made over the years. And they supplied a recording that was issued with the magazine, and that's when someone who listened to it said, you know, this is not the same recording as the one that we've known for all these years. The obvious difference is that the newly issued version plays for about 6 minutes, and the old one is about 7 minutes, which is a pretty substantial difference for a piece of that length. The article in Finnish Music Quarterly explains that the recording that had been given to EMI, the one that was in circulation before that, had been taken from a disc dub that was mislabeled. So the new Andante Festivo, now claimed to be the true Andante Festivo, was issued by the Finnish radio and finally was issued commercially on this CD on the Ondine label. This is track two, a bit of the Andante Festivo. So a rather different recording in sound, not all that dissimilar in terms of the tempo and the overall approach. As it happens, compared to other recordings that have been done of this music, these two are the slow ones. The what we believe is really Sibelius, and the one that we don't really know who conducted the misattributed recording. The one name that has been suggested, and I'll talk a little more about this later, is a fellow who was a music director at the Finnish radio, and his name was Toivo Haapanen. And I'll have a little bit more to say about him. But I think for now, let's talk a bit about Prokofiev. Now, sometime in 1938 in Moscow, Prokofiev conducted a recording of his Romeo and Juliet Suite No. 2. It was issued on 6 10-inch 78s in Russia. Apparently there was a Czech issue on Superphone, presumably from the same Russian masters. In the USA, it was on Disc Records, dubbed onto 12-inch masters, and if you collect David Stone Martin cover art, that's an album you might want, but you wouldn't want it for the quality of the transfer. And it was also issued by English Decca, pressed from Russian masters. Except that Decca never issued the second record, which is the second number of the suite, Juliet, the Young Girl, even though they had assigned a record number to it. Now, later on, this recording was reissued on an LP by Turnabout. And in this version, one of the two sides of Juliet the Young Girl was included. The other one was gone, was missing. And the English collector, Peter Adamson, who looked into this, has speculated, and I think he may be right, but he doesn't have any sort of evidence to back it up. The Turnabout issue may have come from a Decca source. Decca did some recording for Vox at that time, and they distributed their products in England. And maybe the reason that Decca, during the war, did not issue that one missing disc is that, you know, they still had one of the masters, but the other one either never got to them or it was damaged in transit. And so that would be a reasonable explanation, I think, for what we got in the reissue, but we don't know for sure. Now we come to the Phillips CD. This was issued in their Legendary Classics series, coupling Prokofiev with Ravel, conducting his bolero, and there could be a whole other program about attributions involving Maurice Ravel in recordings and piano roles. But when Gramophone magazine reviewed this CD, they were very satisfied to have finally a complete reissue of Prokofiev's famous Romeo and Juliet recording available. But Peter Adamson, the collector, he was not satisfied. He was convinced, hearing this CD, that what Phillips had issued was a different performance altogether. He contacted Gramophone, talked to the reviewer and editors there, and they really wouldn't budge from their position. So Adamson said, well, you know, I'm going to have to prove what I'm saying here, that this is really a different recording. And in 1992, he published the result in Hillendale News, which is the which was at that time the publication of the City of London Phonograph and Gramophone Society, and that's of course the label of one of the original Russian discs. In fact, the one that Decca didn't issue with Juliet, the young girl. So in his discussion, Adamson talks about the general issue, you know, what is it, how do we determine, what evidence can we muster to make a case that one particular recording is of the same performance, you know, as another recording, or is something different? One thing that we can look at is the elapsed time from start to finish of a selection, and what he found was, well, you know, just taking a look at this, several of the movements are very close, but the last number of the suite, which is Romeo at Juliet's Grave, the version on 78s runs 5 minutes and 50 seconds. The Phillips recording, 6 minutes and 29 seconds. So, you know, almost 40 seconds of a fairly substantial difference, you know, for a piece of that length. Of course, there are some limitations to that kind of analysis. It's possible, even in analog, to vary pitch and tempo independently. Of course, it's very easy in digital. If you compare recordings by playing them back, you know, putting them in your sound editor and playing them back at the same time, that can be useful, but there are, if there have been any manipulations such as, you know, some methods of declicking can throw off the timing to some extent. So those things will have to be taken into account. In this case, what Adamson found was that this performance issued by Phillips had been issued once before, 5 years before. It came out in 1983 on a Melodia LP. And he contacted the producer in Japan, the producer of this series, and found, yes, we got it from Melodia, and in fact, it is credited here as a recording owned by MK. So we can be reasonably sure that it hasn't been subject to digital manipulation. In fact, I've not heard the Melodia LP, but Adamson said it sounds pretty much identical to what's on this CD, so you can't really blame No Noise for it anyway. At least in this case. So he also took a look at variations in tempo, and in the same number, the last number of the suite, He found that there are some sections that run about the same tempo in both versions, but then there are some that are much slower on the Philips CD. And he gives small differences, examples of small differences in instrumental playing that he can point to between the two versions. And one clear textual difference as well in the last movement. It looks like there are a couple measures of music included in this version on Philips that don't appear on the 78s. Now, I don't have the 78s, but since this time, there has been issued on Parnassus this Mark Oberthorn transfer from original Russian 78s. So I'm using this as the basis of comparison here. So from this, track three, and if we listen to the passage here, just before the strings come in pianissimo, so track three. Now, on the Philips version, in this same passage, notice how those bass notes are sustained before the high strings come in, and that's track four. So it seems pretty clear, taking all these details into account, that these are two different performances. Peter Adamson tried to get some information from Russia with mixed success. He talked to someone at an archive there who told him that the performance issued here was originally from a film source, but also that it had been released on 78s, on, you know, the numbers, the matrix numbers that are well known as the ones transferred here. So it's not all correct, but, you know, that's the information that they had in their records, and that's what they were able to tell him. So let's see, where does that leave us? Adamson's conclusion, based on his analysis of the performances, he thought that it was at least a good possibility that both these recordings, that this perhaps incorrectly attributed recording, was really by Prokofiev. He couldn't identify it with any other conductor and found enough similarities that he thought, well, maybe it's another Prokofiev performance, but what its source was, where it really came from, seemed to be unclear. So now we can throw a little more light on these issues. I found some information just by sort of randomly searching on the web through the Library of Congress catalog of radio broadcasts, and that's where they house the NBC radio collection. So it turns out that in the 1930s, NBC was doing a lot with shortwave broadcasting. I had heard about, if you know Toscanini, the Salzburg Festival, there are, you know, these recordings that it's been written up in the Ars Journal, and of course, you know, that Seth Winter was involved with the Selenophone recordings. But then there are also these shortwave broadcasts, and I always thought when I first read about them that, you know, it, you know, somebody in their basement, you know, a hobbyist making recordings. No, it turns out it was NBC. They had equipment, relay stations all over the world. They did a number of music broadcasts that you can find, you know, as well as Toscanini. There are others that you can find looking in the Library of Congress, and it wasn't a great medium for music. Shortwave has the advantage of distance, but the disadvantage of what can be pretty bad sound and unreliable performance. In some cases, it was very useful for NBC that they had staff musicians on hand to come in if the thing just completely faded out. Well, you know, let's get Mr. Chomsky and Mr. Primrose or whomever, you know, in to, you know, play us a little Mozart. But it did turn out to be very useful for NBC because of political events in the 1930s and 1940s. You know, so as you look through the Library of Congress catalog, you see fewer musical events when you look for shortwave, when you look for that keyword, and a lot more of, you know, hell breaking loose in Europe and elsewhere in the world, but, you know, largely in Europe. So NBC made some recordings of these broadcasts. I wondered why they did it, and so I went, of course, to the source for questions like that. I bought the PDF version of Dr. Beale's wonderful document, The Making and Use of Recordings in Broadcasting Before 1936. And I read it and learned a few things. So apparently they made reference recordings because they could, because it was a lot cheaper now that they had lacquer discs, coated aluminum lacquer discs, to make recordings of things that someone might be interested in down the road instead of, you know, having the technology of needing to cut a wax blank and process like you would do a commercial recording, which is, you know, just for making one record, it's a very expensive thing. So they didn't do it to play those recordings back on the air. That's clear. They still, the years we're talking about here, 1938, 1939, that was still their policy. They almost entirely disallowed any such thing. So there are the reference recordings, and we have here one such. Not to be used for any purpose except with written consent of a vice president in charge of programs. It's made for reference purposes only. Music from the Soviet Union is how this is listed in the Library of Congress online catalog. I'm going to play now the very beginning of the program, and we'll have a little bit of the music just to give you an idea. And notice the wording that the announcer uses. I think, you know, we're going to try, we're going to attempt, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is track 5.
Sergei Prokofiev, known from coast to coast in the United States, not only as one of Russia's foremost contemporary composers, but also as one of the outstanding concert pianists of this day, first won international attention as a composer at the age of 18 with his first piano concerto. He has written 5 works in this form, 4 symphonies, 4 ballets, numerous chamber music works, and many songs and piano compositions. Just recently, he completed a new symphonic suite, Romeo and Juliet. And in a few moments, this composition, we hope, will be heard for the first time in the United States. The National Broadcasting Company will attempt to bring you now a portion of a concert conducted by Prokofiev himself. We invite you to join us as we attempt to establish contact with Moscow, Russia.
As the broadcast goes on, between the movements, a female announcer is heard. Sounds like she's coming from Moscow, and that's track six.
And now listen to part two, entitled Juliet.
So it goes on like this. Through the fifth movement, there are two more to go, but at that point, after the fifth movement concludes, the broadcast has reached 25 minutes and the quality is not all that good, and the announcer doesn't even tell you he's cutting it short, but you know, we've heard from Moscow, a wonderful blah, 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 and then it's done. So, you know, the performance presumably goes on in Moscow, but we don't hear any more of it here. Now, I'm assuming that this was a live broadcast and they're not playing a recording in Moscow. We don't know that for a fact, but presumably NBC, you know, they had made the arrangements to carry it. So the one thing that makes it a little improbable, except that it was done for an international broadcast, 9 to 9:30 p.m., I believe that is 6 in the morning, or some such, you know, in Moscow. I don't know, I forget now what time they were on, you know, during the war and da 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 da, da or just before. But it was awfully early for Prokofiev and the orchestra. So when we compare the timings of the movements, and the transfer that I got from Library of Congress just happens to run pretty much at the same speed, and you know, you put them into the editor and they're like, you know, pretty much right on the money in terms of the timing. So the complete movements run about the same time. That's a good check. And then I heard this. Let's see. We want to listen. Okay, this is the Philips CD. This is a very brief excerpt from Juliet, the Young Girl. This is track seven. Could we play track seven one more time, please? There's a little noise or something. Maybe a stray pizzicato? I'm not exactly sure, you know. But let's listen to track eight. And there it is again. same thing. So I am pretty confident that we can say now this is conducted by Prokofiev and that it was done on September 17th, 1938, as the date would have been in Moscow. So let's see. So that's what we conclude here. Now, a few more words about Sibelius before we're done. The Sibelius, of course, also has a disc for us to listen to, and we can hear the last item we'll hear here is the introduction of Sibelius and the start of the music, and that's track 9.
At the beginning of our program, I have the pleasure to introduce to you our great composer, Jean Sibelius, who welcomes this opportunity to appear once again after an interval of 24 years before an American audience. Dr. Sibelius, who has not conducted an orchestra for about 10 years, on this special occasion wants to honor the American friends of his music and the great American nation by conducting himself one of his own works. You will now hear the Helsinki Grand Radio Concert Orchestra playing the Andante Festivo, composed and conducted by Jean Sibelius.
Plays a bit fast, but if you bring it at least to the same speed as we have here, we find this appears to be the same recording that we believe is the real Sibelius. It runs about 6 minutes when you get it at the right pitch. And it appears to be, the same thing based on the comparisons that I've done. So, those are my conclusions about the attribution of these recordings. There are some things that I haven't researched. So, in terms of Prokofiev, I'd love to know more about the source of the broadcast recording. Was it actually done on film, and what sources still exist in Russia? I said I was going to come back to Toivo Hapanen, and in this broadcast, at the very end of it, when the sound gets bad enough and the thing has gone on to half an hour, they fade down his performance of Finlandia. So, of course, he was familiar with the way the composer did the Andante Festivo because, he was right there and involved in this recording. There is also a rehearsal recording of Sibelius doing a very brief rehearsal. There is part of it, a very brief part of it, on the internet, on the site sibelius.fi. I have also heard, but haven't really been able to research extensively, the issue that was on the Unique Opera Recordings label, which contains, in worse sound than what I heard on the internet, but at more length, the Sibelius rehearsal. But there's at least, as well as containing a complete Andante Festivo, which could be a second Andante Festivo conducted by Sibelius, the rehearsal version, there is a fairly obvious edit in there. So, without having done the comparisons, I would say that is something for further research. And At this time, I'm not going to offer any conclusions on that. Well, finally, I would like to give my thanks to Peter Adamson, to the publishers of Finnish Music Quarterly, folks at the Library of Congress, Packard Campus for Audiovisual Conservation, and NBC Universal Archives. And thank you very much for your attention.
Take a couple of questions, please.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the
Are you familiar with the symposium, the alleged symposium issue of the Andante Festivo?
Thank you.
The ionization disc.
Yes. This is a weird disc. I mean, all said and done. You know, Henry Wood doing Beethoven, the, of course, ionization by Varese, a theremin concerto by Anis Fulehan, and played wonderfully by Clara Rockmore, of course, and the Andante Festivo. And this is, even though this came out in the year 2000, it is the false Andante Festivo. So
taking it back.
Well, but then, you know, it does keep it available, whoever it actually has conducted it. So if you can have both now. I believe this is out of print, but Archive CD has it, or you can find a used copy like I did, from whatever source. Pristine Audio also has this version, and of course for the 78s one, you want this. So, yes.
When you're dealing with 78s, of course, you are also dealing with alternate takes, and that's something which you don't always find out on the on the reissues. And with Mark Orbitorn, I was the one that had discovered the alternate takes on the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto, and that RCA's ledgers lied, because in around 41 or 42, they completely changed, except for the one side that they only had one take. I think it was side eight. They completely changed to a different set of takes, and then in around 1952, 53, forged the ledger sheet in the artist folder to show that the takes which were on the microgroove issues and on the on the wartime and post-war 78s as being the approved masters rather than the secondary masters. Going back to the original session sheet in the 20s, you see which ones really were the approved. Sometimes you will find, you know, there were in that Rachmaninoff second, there are three takes in existence of several of the sides. And on a lot of 78 sets, especially on Columbia, alternate takes were issued. The Rhapsody in Blue, the Oscar Levant, you take a look at four or five different copies of the set, and you'll see different take numbers on this side or that side. And the same thing also with the Richard Hale Boston Symphony, Peter and the Wolf. There are several alternate takes.
And of course, earlier, I know for Columbia, it was not uncommon in these sets for, you know, an English issue to have different takes from an American one. You know,
whatever. And the LPs don't always tell you what they've pulled them from.
No, or they, you know, just like Adamson found in consulting this fellow Vladimir Koliada at the Archives of Sound Recordings in Moscow. You know, he gave the information he had, but it was wrong. You know, what they had to offer, you know, that someone had, you know.
Having been there in Moscow, I could tell you, I can understand why.
Thank you.
Yeah, one comment about the Rhapsody in Blue. As Dennis and Seth both know, because all of the Columbia 78s throughout the 40s are dubbings from 16-inch masters, the take numbers on the 78s are not necessarily, they don't reflect the actual take numbers that were done on the on the original session masters. They're the numbers of if there's a take three on a 78, it means it's a third dubbing, but it doesn't mean it's a take three from the original session.
In many cases, you have more take numbers than exist on the 16-inch disc.
Right. I remember specifically. Claudio Arau trying to get through Iberia over a two-year period. Yeah. They assigned them take zeros, meaning as holds for the take ones. In other words, whichever was the approved take became take one, but that may have been the third take in the session. Could have been the second take, the fourth take from the next day. Yeah. So, more questions, folks?
I suspect we haven't heard the last of it.
Yeah. No. I want to add in something. It sounds like, I got a funny feeling, this was a film. Because there's an incredible amount of pause when it, you know, it's when the announcer comes on and then it starts up again.
Yeah, and all of the movements are like that, very long pauses.
And at 6 o'clock in the morning,
After 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So the trick is finding that Melodia LP to get the best sound.
Yeah. Right. And I haven't heard it. Based on what Peter Adamson said, you know, it sounds pretty much like it does on the Philips CD, but you know, who knows what their early application of no noise has inflicted on it. Anyone who gets that CD, that's really a fairly awful transfer of Ravel's Bolero. But you know, that's.
Can I add one other thing in? You mentioned that rehearsal of Sibelius was on a UORC.
Yes.
That may be the only instrumental selection that Eddie Smith ever put out, because everything he did was always vocal and operatic.
Yeah, and about it. Everything else on that LP is vocal.
Right.
But he just, I guess he had that from some source, and there it was.
Maybe because you hear Sibelius saying something, maybe the vocal recording.
Yeah, I thought about dubbing it and playing a bit, but you know, it was at the last minute, and of course it runs at the wrong speed and it's off center. So you know, I said no. When I have a little time, I'll.
Do you expect anything less from Eddie Smith?
No, of course not. Of course.
Why am I surprised? Very good. Thank you. Great. Good.